committed to ending on time. Because people have schedules, they have to meet, planes they have to catch, and that sort of thing. So we're going to keep this moving along. For the next, what is now about 54 minutes that we have left, what we want to do here is have devote 15 minutes of that time to a bit of a discussion about philanthropy and its role in moving these things forward. We are then going to move to a discussion of the goals that we set out and hear from you to what extent you think we have moved the needle on any of those. And then I am going to announce to you, before that, we're going to give Bob Slater 5 minutes to talk about an issue which he thinks, well, which I agree, was not really raised, which is really important. We just want to make sure that it stays on people's radar screens. And then we want to have a bit of a discussion about what has occurred here, what you consider the priority, key, critical issues are. Because we're going to produce a report from this. This is one of the things we promised the Spencer Foundation. And all of you are part of that report. And the way that you will be, all of you part of that report, is we're going to be sending out a survey afterwards to hear from you about what was key, what are priorities, what wasn't said that needed to have been said, and allow you to make your case for why certain things ought to be priorities in this. And that will all be incorporated into the report. So we will also, Lori wants me to let you know that we will be sending out information very soon about reimbursements. So all of you who would love to get your money before Christmas will be hearing from us. And we're also going to send out to everybody the announcement about the TESOL quarterly issue, about the Bilingualism Matters website, which is very useful for everyone in this room, and some information from Rhonda about the Beloved Community. That'll all be coming to you over email, okay? So you should be looking for emails from us. All right, so now we want to have a little bit of discussion about the role of philanthropy. Susan Eaton is joining us from Brandeis and the center that she directs to talk about this, and then Magali will be joining to talk about how that has worked in a couple of instances here in California.
Hi, everybody. It's great to be here. So I think my work is quite different than most of the people here in the room. I've done a lot of different things in my career, but one thing that has stayed kind of a common thread throughout is my fascination and interest in what John Powell, who I think a lot of you probably know his work, he's at Berkeley at the Haas Institute, calls bridging remedies and bridging policies, right? And so what Powell talks about is that in times of demographic change, in times of fear and scarce resources, there's kind of these two opposite policies, both of which, and actions, both of which get really animated and enhanced during those times. And one type of thing are these bridging policies, which are about connecting people and about widening your circle of human concern. And the other types of policies are about breaking. And I think we see that now on the federal level with our president. And so what has brought me to write and research and learn more about and just be really fascinated both with the successes and the potential of dual language, but also the challenges and equity that it faces, is that fascination with it being primarily at its root, at least potentially, of one of those bridging policies. So what I do at my center is called the Silliman Center for the Advancement of Social Justice Philanthropy. We do a variety of things, but one of the big kind of strands of our work is to be a place where funders can go to learn about specific topic areas of funding. And so we will listen to philanthropy to tell us what they care about, but I think probably 80% of the time what we're doing is going out there and looking at policies, programs, efforts that have been overlooked by philanthropy. Things exactly like dual language immersion, which I feel really should be moved out of just the education funder realm. It is a type of policy and program and practice, especially if done well, especially with equity at the center, which all of you are here are devoted to doing, can really interest funders who are interested in democracy, who are interested in community engagement, who are concerned about racial equity, and a growing number of very big funders now who would never dream of funding things like an educational program in the past, who now are looking for a counterforce to Donald Trump and to hate. And I think that there are numerous on-ramps into that philanthropists can find into this work. And so what I'm hoping to do moving forward after this is to take all of your wonderful papers, the report that Patricia and Bob and everyone is going to put out, and all of that work is going to help inform, for me, a funder's brief that I can then get out to funders, and a presentation that incorporates to multimedia and video, maybe have a couple of you speaking on the videos, that we can do a kind of package for funders, and we can go out and educate big funders and also different kind of categories of funders who probably never thought of dual language immersion being something that they want to fund. And I have to say, I think that especially the equity work in dual language immersion is going to be really interesting and really attractive to a lot of funders, especially in the education space, especially in the social justice funder space, because I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with funders. A lot of my work, as Patricia knows, has been around K-12 school integration, trying to make it possible to have diverse schools, first of all, but then also trying to do the work, trying to get the work funded and going that makes diverse schools actually racially equitable. So racial justice and racial equity within diverse schools. And I often mention, whenever I'm talking to funders, and I've been doing a lot of that around school integration, I do bring up DLI and what the funders tell me. They're like, well, I thought that that was just this thing that like was for white people and they were taking it all over. So that story is out there. That story is out there among funders. And I think the answer is yes, but it doesn't need it have to be that way, right? And so I think that there is an appetite for paying attention to those equity issues. And I've just heard so many different ideas coming out from folks about things that could be funded. I mean, one of the things that's true is that funders do not like to directly fund school districts, generally. There are some funders who do, but they don't like to. So I think going forward, what I would love to, so I'm gonna be writing this brief and I'm gonna be working on these materials. And I'm going to be bothering a lot of you to say, review this. Make sure that I characterize your research in the right way. Make sure I didn't mess this up. Is there anything I need to elaborate on here? So I'm going to be doing that. But the other thing I want to hear about from all of you are ideas for, outside of the regular school district, what in the best case scenario would you have happen? Would you have funded? Would it be work on, working with white parents who are coming into school districts and helping them understand how not to be colonizers? Would it be around curriculum? Would it be sending teachers to conferences where they could learn about culturally sustained pedagogy? Yes, yes. All those kinds of things. I want to hear everything. And I may be sending out something to all of you as well to hear what those ideas are. So I just wanted to let you know that work is going to be happening and I'm going to be bugging a lot of you. So do we have any time for questions or do we just want
to
move?
We can come back to it during the session.
Right.
This is one of the goals.
Okay.
You want me to go up there?
Yeah, you have to.
Then I don't have any prepared comments, but Patricia asked me to share some of my experiences in the role of philanthropy and where philanthropy is going, at least in California, in influencing policy, public policy, helping to shape public policy around equity for English learners. 12 years ago, the Center for Equity for English Learners, I founded it with support of a foundation. And I think that some of these stories about how do you actually get foundations to adopt a strategy focused on English learners and to help launch ideas and new innovations, well, it comes from a lot of failure. It comes from a lot of failed attempts and also the evolution of ideas, vetting those ideas with other partners. And so I was able to convince the dean, who was able to convince the president, that the board of trustees, who had the foundation president for Bank of America, that this was an idea that trustees, who in a private institutions, have an obligation to bring in resources. So that's one aspect of it, is having those engaged conversations at many levels about the ideas that we have, about the research that we do. The second is that led to sort of the ability to articulate the vision, right? What is equity for English learners? What does it mean? What approaches we take? How do we use asset-based approaches to the communities that we work with? And being able to craft out practices and engagement with a broader policy field, with research and with professional development that really enact those principles. And so that work, I work with amazing colleagues. Shelley told you about some of my colleagues who are the curriculum developers for professional development, for teachers who are able to help children, English learners, develop curriculum that is really authentic, that is really meaningful, that is really responsive to what their interests are through an inquiry lens. So fast forward to the last maybe 3 years, and there's a very interesting new era of program officers in foundations that I think are very interested in this kind of work. And I want to share about two of them, whose program officers, one of whom, John Garcia, who couldn't be here, co-sponsored this event, but has also co-sponsored some of our work. And they're crafting a common policy agenda. So it's not just about projects, it's not just about research, but really funding initiatives that really influence state policy around equity for English learners. So California Community Foundation is one of them. John Garcia is a young whippersnapper, but has his vision and is really honing his vision that he's trying to craft and bring to the California Community Foundation. So he's funding initiatives such as these that really influence policy and move that needle. The other is the Sobrato Family Foundation. So I don't think anybody talked about the Sobrato Early Academic Literacy. And so Sobrato Family Foundation is a foundation in Silicon Valley. They have lots of money. lots of money.
It's okay to say.
Yes, lots and lots of money. And their program officer is Ken G. Traynor, who came from the Irvine Foundation. And he has been very instrumental in helping the Sobrato Family Foundation have a sharper focus on equity for English learners. And it began with funding Sobrato Early Academic Literacy Policy. Lori Olson's work that first started with the identification of long-term English learners, whatever concerns we have about labels, that was very instrumental. But then it evolved into preventing long-term English learners by really forming professional development for teachers of young English learners in pre-K through 12 schools that is now in the process of being embedded in the research. But then Sobrato decided, after they funded that heavily for the development of this professional development, they replicated, they tested it. It's in 130 schools statewide. It's in Los Angeles Unified School District and Long Beach Unified School District. And they decided to then shift their attention to really shaping public policy, public education policy in California around English learners. What did that mean? It meant like $109 or $110 million investment. That's a lot of money in about a 5 to 10 year period. And Kenji Traynor had a big role in doing that. So I think that your event that you're having about bringing other philanthropy together is really important. So there's three principles three focus areas, and Kenji is also bringing other foundation program officers together to kind of buy into that idea to shape English learner policy that is informed by research. We need to look at things like the implementation of the local control funding formula, what it means for English learners, and funding research that supports and advances policy. The English Learner Roadmap that Shelley alluded to, which is a policy that really changes the language, changes the discourse about what it means to educate English learners based on research-based principles, and the bilingual teacher pipeline, something that we've been talking about here. And the expectation from philanthropy is that we're present in the conversations. So being able to say, yes, I will go to a meeting, and I will talk to wherever you may be, I think that that's some of the learning that I have experienced in being able to have those kind of conversations with project officers who know that they can count on you. They can count on us to be present, to talk about our research, but then look at the practical implementation of that research, because the interest in shaping public policy seems to be elevating in priorities in terms of foundations and philanthropy. And there's a really great book called Policy Patrons that is very informative. There are case studies of where philanthropic investments have gone right and where they've gone wrong. They're great case studies to learn from. And so I think that we're working together to this idea of working with philanthropy to advance advocacy for English learners, to shift public policy, public education policy for English learners, and having a real presence, but by having opportunities to use our research to inform those policies. And that's all I wanted to share with you today.
You can do sit wherever you want. Thank you.
One advertisement for Susan. You can have your name.
Oh, thank you.
One advertisement. Susan, if you haven't read Susan's work, it's wonderful. She's a great writer. So if you help her, she can tell a great part of it's the way you tell the story. Help her. I want to go back and mention one issue. That I think we have not generally ignored. Now, do it in 2 minutes. Segregation is alive and well in the United States. Anybody who's seen this recent statistics can tell you that Latinx segregation is now ahead of African American segregation in the United States. It's in our neighborhoods, it's in our schools. I have a colleague, her name is Patricia Gondra, who's written and talked extensively about this for many, many years. And we talked about having another session and a paper on this. There just wasn't time in the 2 days, so we take partial responsibility. But dual language, the issue of school placement in neighborhoods, the demography, understanding how you change neighborhoods is really a critical issue. Strand programs, whole way programs, its impact. I could tell you stories from home in Washington, D.C. about school placement and how that has an enormous impact, in, not only in the district, but in affluent Montgomery County, Maryland. It's a critical issue, and we need to put that on the table because it can be a game changer, positive and negative. In terms of how it impacts what is really the untold, misunderstood story in the United States that somehow segregation is over. It's not. So that's a critical issue on our equity, in my mind, in our equity list that relates to dual language learning in the United States. With that, we can go to the... One example I'll give you, Montgomery County, Maryland. We were engaged with them almost 2 years ago. Believe it or not, there are almost no two-way programs in a county that's now predominantly Latinx. It's 52%, I believe, in the schools. There were no two-way immersion. New superintendent came in, demanded that they create new immersion programs. The administrator of World Languages in Montgomery County decided unilaterally that they would put a program in a predominantly Spanish-speaking school in the northern part of the county. A whole school program, thought it was a no-brainer, brought all the parents in, convened a meeting, and the parents threw them out. They said, we don't want this program. You're telling me I can't send my child to my home school if they don't want to be in dual language immersion, and I don't want them in dual language immersion. So they had to run out of the school and find another school where they incidentally unilaterally are instituting a new program this year, but that program was only 42% Spanish speaking, so it seemed to be a bit more hospitable. There are stories we can tell you over and over again about how the relationship between where you put the school, how you present it to the parents, and the demographics in the neighborhood really impact. So, Tricia, you want to add?
First, I want to add something.
Yes. You have something to say?
I do want to add something, because in California, the first five programs were under court-ordered desegregation mandates. And so in a response to desegregation that would move us away from forced busing, we did it through program. And so San Francisco Unified, San Jose Unified, San Diego Unified, all of us put the two-way program together as a way to meet the desegregation court mandates that said that we had to have integrated school settings, and then and thus the program, and thus the one-third, 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 or the 50-50, that, thus that design, because it was court mandated. So I know a lot of people don't understand that about two-way, but when two-way started, we were under court orders to integrate districts. Yes.
That's very interesting. I would just add that Joy E. Helped me do an analysis here in California of the concentration of students and what kinds of schools they went to, and we looked at the 10 deciles from the lowest performing to the highest performing. When we disaggregated by race and ethnicity and language, we found that the kids who were what we call English learners, which I call immigrant students, the children of immigrant families, were the most likely of all subgroups, every subgroup included, to be concentrated in the lowest performing schools. I think that tells us something about what we need to do. We need to create equitable programs. We need to not close down programs that are working for these kids, but we do need to get these kids desegregated out of these very, very low performing schools where they are the largest group. So, actually I thought Bob was going to talk more about the demographics and all of that, but maybe we'll insert some of that in the report. And I think that's... So we have half an hour left, and what we wanted to do, Bob, I think you're going to help me do this,
yes,
too, because we wanted to review the goals that we started out with, try and get an understanding about whether we have actually moved the needle on any of these, and what you think we really need to focus on. So establishing where we are today with two-way dual immersion, have we moved the needle at all in terms of understanding where we are, or what do we need to do next? Any thoughts? Greg?
First of all, I think we need to find a foundation that would help us do a survey so we could actually find out how many dual language immersion programs there are in the country, mm-hmm, about how many students we're talking about, because nobody knows. In the old days, Cal did that self-reporting study, but since then there's been nothing.
And Cal's study was not totally voluntary,
yeah,
right?
But
so we never really knew.
We just said it.
Right. So I think that's excellent to put on the list.
I was thinking I'm going to the meeting of the Council of Chief State School Officers in February to talk about possible work with them, and I was thinking one thing that we could talk about is starting to do some data collection at the state level on DLI growth and bilingual education growth, and I think there's something like 40 states that are in the English Learner SCAS there, so it's a possibility.
That's great. That's the same one.
I just wanted to circle back to Bob's sounds
like a lot of time. John Scott, graduate of But I think your point underscores something that's been touched on here in the past 2 days, which is the importance of leadership training and awareness. Because in Connecticut, where I've been now for 12 years, there's just so much harm that's been done. There have been so many programs that have been dismantled by superintendents who have just been decided. And we have a bilingual state statute where theoretically we're required to do all of the education if you have funding more to the same language. And despite that, the language other programs have been completely dismantled by superintendents who decided they don't want to do it. And other places that are very fruitful opportunities for dual language, it's just not even on the table. The superintendents just won't consider it, or the principals won't consider it. So I think as much as we empower teachers and families, if we don't get the leadership on this to understand it and to advocate for it too, it's not going to go anywhere.
I would certainly agree that one of the things that was missing from our conversation was more of a focus on leadership, because I think we're rife with stories also about preparing teachers to do the good work. They go into a school with poor leadership and everything is undone, and they're totally unsupported in all the things that we've worked so hard to prepare them for. So I would put that on a list of things we really need to get a sharper focus on. Nobody is required to have a bilingual credential or even to have studied anything about immigrant students in order to be a principal. So you have to have the credential to be in the classroom, but not to be the principal of the school that is overseeing all of this. Yeah.
More about where we are. Any other thoughts?
I think we're going to number two.
I know. Well, that's why I wanted to talk to you about one for 1 second.
What you're doing.
Everybody wants to move to number two. I just want to make sure we dwell a little on where we spent a lot of time talking about where we are today. So just to be some clarity on where we are. And you can think about it more. It doesn't end today.
Yeah, so I think that, I'm sorry to bring us back to number one, but I think it's important to understand policy contexts in all of the states. And that's something that philanthropy is going to want to know about. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't want to support things forever. They want to see a possibility that eventually the state government, there's going to be a competitive grant program there. Eventually, when we soon elect a Democrat president, that there's going to be money from the federal government to pick it up. So I think really understanding the specific policy context and where it's right, like California and Massachusetts are two places I can think of where.
We've got two people in the room who are just primed to do that work, and that's the president, Francesca, who've been doing this work anyway, and I know that they are ready to take that on.
Extending from that remark about where we are today, terminology, mm-hmm. I worry a lot. If we're all not telling the same story using the same terms and concepts, it's really confusing. So I don't intend to resolve. You're going to talk about AIR report, right?
Well, I think they made some great recommendations
right,
for
they do.
A program, at least. And I don't think we're there on the students, but I think everyone should look at the AIR. I can't call it AIR report again. But the AIR report and look at the recommendations, because they do have developmental bilingual there. Under one way, under dual language, and I think it's pretty inclusive. Their recommendations, that was one that was done by this, was there very anonymous. I think it's done quite well.
Recommendations for terminology.
Terminology.
Oh.
We can include those when we send everything out, and people can comment on them. But
yeah.
I do think when we talk about two-way dual language, we talk about dual language immersion, we talk about dual language education. Once you start messing around with all this terminology, boy, outsiders say, I don't know what you're talking about. And you're talking about, is that the same program? I don't know. So, just Mr. Connor?
Just one sentence on that. As somebody who writes about this for the general public from time to time, editors hate that stuff. They hate it. You try to say, well, we wanted to do dual language letters, and they're like, no, our readers don't know what that is. And you say, well, we'll explain it. They say, we're like 30 right. years away from where you are in terms of this. If you could, the time you spend explaining the term is time you could have otherwise spent like, connecting to the reader. The editors are not having this.
One example.
You have to be precise about what you mean, though, because it is just stuff shorthand. It used to say students who are learning Spanish and English or something like that,
mm-hmm.
so that you actually are very precise.
Yeah.
Because that, even say dual language learn, that's not precise.
Yeah,
that's another issue.
I wish this were not the case, but it is the case that if you try, I mean,
but
editors
shouldn't be
they're
using
not
that
really.
For the general public.
They're,
you should be being precise about who they are,
yeah.
not just using them.
What would you use as a...
I use whatever the editors let me use at this point. Because that's going to be the truth of the matter.
What is it you are learning into languages?
Usually that kind of jargon gets cut, right?
Literally
varies by the outlet. So sometimes they're willing to give you lots of room to go through all of the explanation, and a lot of the time they just say, look, just call them English learners, that's...
Oh, I see what you're meaning. So they default to the deficit thing.
I think there's a strong sentiment to get away from the deficit kind of labeling of English learner or English language learner among people who work in the field. So I think that's a needle we have to move.
Right.
Yeah.
I was just going to say one last thing for number one is we establish where we are with the research in two-way dual language immersion. I think we have to be careful that we're looking at outcome research on all different kinds of levels, but there's a lot of good qualitative research out there that talks about what is happening. I mean, that we have that with teachers and perspectives and families and politics and policies. So there is quite a lot out there. So it's a huge amount to document, and I don't want to forget that we have all these different fields, different disciplines, different kinds of journals that write about this, from ed policy to teacher ed to linguistics and education. So it's huge, but we've got to try to hit all those angles when we establish where we are.
I just wanted to comment very quickly about possible confusion. Remember, for a while before Proposition 58, people were fighting that they didn't have bilingual programs, so they called them dual language.
So I've
actually called it two-way immersion, right? Because I was trying to figure out, I want to get away from the dual whatever mm-hmm. that might mean. So just know that the schools in the area where I am will say, our dual language program, and I'm assuming two groups of children, and no, they're not two groups of children.
Just pay attention to this, please, when we send it out, and give it some thought, because it's really destructive for us to just throw out letters without.
But also, our grad students are taking really good notes on this, so don't worry.
A lot of typing. So many notes.
Yeah.
So
as we do that, and if we think about it as two-way, and we say two groups, I think we need two.
And the fact that it's never.
It's never. And at what point is there actually a need, and that if I may point you out, at what point is there a need to say this is a two-way program because it has a very specific population? Mm-hmm. But most of our programs are anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in Massachusetts, so we had a very clear mm-hmm. Anglo-Latino population,
mm-hmm.
no more, but that was very clear and that was two-way for us. But right now, in two-way, is such a way.
And our populations are evolving too. So.
Right.
So I think that it questions the use of two-way. We're about that, if it makes sense.
Yeah, Lydia? Still on one?
So I'm on the EL student term. Is this a really multilingual home language evolution? I'm trying to, all the things that I'm talking about, right? Because it's what comes from the home in the different layers, the evolution of language. I'm thinking about language learners, but we're all language learners. So I'm still struggling with that with the term, because I think we do have to think about that. English learner.
I would not advocate inventing anything. so much out there now.
Let's just hear from Rosa.
I just think I'm thinking about Catherine's research, and she's been very successful in describing two-way as Esther knows, you know, by using native English speakers, native Spanish speakers, and bilinguals, and that seems to make a lot of sense to the field. So native English speakers, native Spanish speakers, and if it's native Mandarin speakers, native Korean speakers, I mean, it's clear kind of like who's in it, and then the bilingual kids they're also in the middle of that.
Okay, we will consider that. So, for number two, this is a lengthy one.
I know.
We'll never get through number two. But we're going to send out a survey, and we're going to ask this question of you for number two. And then we're going to compile all of that, so we will have 40 responses to that question.
Yeah, and we're going to come back to you and ask you to prioritize. Because everything can't be equal.
And then you're saying that people just listen to us. Mm.
Yeah. So let's number three. To begin a sustained and open dialogue among researchers and practitioners. Have we done that?
Did we finish two?
Have we done it?
What do you mean?
I would actually start my three listed here that are practitioners. I understand.
Look at them.
There are not a lot of practitioners.
Wait a minute. How many people in the room? We've actually lost some people too, like Shelley, who's a practitioner. Lori Olson, who's a practitioner, sort of researching practitioner. No,
a practitioner.
Is that
my practitioner?
Yeah.
Are there, you know, like, are there dual students talking in this conversation? Or, you know,
no.
Are there dual parents who aren't trained?
We need to go beyond that. But I think the first thing was dialogue among researchers and practitioners.
I want to speak to that point. I've been so enriched by the perspective of the research, but I do sometimes, at times, I've felt a disconnect about what the research is proposing and what I am seeing on a day-to-day basis in the schools and the progress and the richness and what's emerging from the practice. And so I felt like, are you speaking about the schools that I'm seeing?
Yes.
I didn't feel that all the time. So I would say that maybe we fell short of portraying what is actually happening in our field that we are addressing from the theoretical perspective of the research.
Wow, that's a tough one. I mean, you really need to think about that carefully. I mean, there's a lot of research, you may have something to comment on this as well. I mean, there's a lot of, I've been pushing the concept of the researcher-practitioner partnership. It's a very different concept. If you don't really haven't read about it carefully, just go to the UT Grant Foundation website, and they have a lot about it, and send you to a major article about it, but it's a very different philosophy about researchers not doing things to practitioners, working with them, understanding the process, but it's not telling the story, because the story they tell may not be the one you want. So it's a very, but yes, there's not a rich research base here yet. It's growing, but it's getting there. But I think we want to hear from you about what would be the logical steps in building this partnership between research. It's not here. It's a start. It's not here. It was tough to get exactly the right mix.
With a 40-person cap.
And not exactly a lot of people who said no. It was hard to replace them. So, Dick, you?
Yeah, I'm prepared to challenge open and sustained. I don't think it's totally open yet, because I think there's a lot of issues about ELs versus non-ELs and what the rhetoric is to be all-inclusive. I don't think we've touched that enough. And certainly sustained depends, Patricia, on what happens next after this. So I think it's the beginning of a good conversation.
Well, that's what I was focusing on, was
begin.
Michael.
Well, I guess... in some ways, the work that we did with Rand and what also just in terms of like alternative work, it's just about that being a stronger partnership and empowering the K-12 practitioners to, you know the theory, know those things, but then actually have that also go up in terms of, here are the things that we're trying out. And we've been stepping into improvement science, which to me is about really starting to put some of this equity work into action instead of just admiring problems or to really wallowing in our, you know, but the overwhelmingness. I mean, I sat here and I shared some of them, like, oh my gosh, I'm feeling overwhelmed, and how do I actually approach that? And I feel like if we bring practitioners into that, the dialogue, and set it up for opportunities to network, to, I mean, that's the whole thing with improvement science, is about how do you, get a focused problem with the user in mind, and then how do you set that up in a really rapid cycle of failure to get improvement, and then how do you network around that and disseminate that, to me would be where I would like to go with this. I mean, I'm super excited about all the things I heard, I'm overwhelmed, but I also want to go back and see, what can I do now to change what's happening and not feel so like there's so much I can't.
Which is one consideration about focus on the practitioners. Every time a practitioner has raised a hand and didn't say something, it's been really, really useful. So I've been really taking notes. So I think it's been incredibly important to have the few of you here who are here. But I think that most of the equity conversation is going on in the research and the academic field. And we even hear from people out in the field that if we were to talk about these same issues in the same way, it'd probably close down our programs. Because we have to get to a point where we're clear on the research, we're clear on the direction, and we have some language to talk about equity that works in Arizona and Missouri, besides California and Massachusetts. So I think we're on a journey to that.
I might add to that, if we're equity focused, researchers need access, and they need access to data, they need access to students, they need access to information. The limitations of research thus far have been an inability to disaggregate and look at enough data to tell the story about what's happening. And so we all have to pay more, knowing we can't do random assignment. There are other ways to do research and to come up with important findings that help these programs answer important questions. So part of the priority here is to identify the questions, and then related to that is to develop a research agenda that helps address those questions, and then find the data and build the tradition to keep doing that. Connor, you have one, then we probably
should. Well, we have Connor, we have Christina.
I work at a think tank in D.C., right? I work on education policy, and I live amongst these other think tanks in D.C. who all work on education policy. And they're all funded by the philanthropic world, which thinks of itself as concerned with education equity. Broadly speaking, they really are. And in this room, we've talked about almost none of what they care about. We're not even close to what they care. We haven't said anything about the Every Student Succeed Act, not single at all. I don't think we said the word. Did it come up? I mean, once. Okay, so we haven't talked about transportation in any kind of serious way. We haven't talked about funding in any detailed way. We haven't talked about weighted lotteries. We haven't talked about classification and accountability. But once, we didn't talk about Latino or Latinx parent preferences and how that intersects with school choice. We didn't talk about early ed, but briefly in one paper. We didn't get anywhere near talking about building data and accountability around former ELs into variety of different ways that every EL policies, we didn't really talk about actual serious specific updates to teacher licensure policy. There's so many things these people care about that are related to equity. It's not the research community that's leading on equity. There's this huge, like people with tons of money who want to fund ESSA implementation. If you can find a DLI angle of that, you have funding. You just have funding. But you have a future. You have a whole agenda you can build around that. We've talked about none of what they care about. At all, which is, I guess, sort of more 4 and 5 here, but there's this huge big funders right there just like slavering to spend money on linguistic equity?
Well, yes and no.
So, Christine?
I think we might be working with different funders. Linguistic equity is too small, but there are, you're right, there are a ton of funders out there who are concerned about racial equity and who are, have come lately to it and who aren't terribly sophisticated and who I think would be very interested in funding this, but you're right, you do have, part of it is telling the story and finding the on-ramp for those, but I think the on-ramps are there. I just don't think that the story's been told yet about how it connects to the existing missions and visions and goals of a lot of great researchers.
We have 7 minutes. Christina?
Yes. Going back to question number two about how to begin to sustain this open dialogue, I have always been referring to a study, and many people in this room are part of the study. It's called Urgent Research Questions and Issues in Dual Language Education. It was a manuscript that was put together in 2019. Some of you that are in the room, I won't name you because we don't have time. But here, I have worked from the questions that were developed by this group. And they were talking in 2009 about what does my literacy development mean? What is the political climate? What are cross-cultural goals for dual language education? What is the role of demographics and the success of dual language programs? I've taken many of these questions in working with doctoral students so that they develop their own research agenda. So from this manuscript, we've got like 5 different dissertations that have come out of this. They just really focus on that. I was speaking with Esther, who's one of the authors here. But I think that in moving forward, we should also look at what has already been done and what are some of the questions that already exist that really remain to be answered before really focusing on, let's start some new questions. So if you haven't seen this article, it's not.
Christina, send it to us and we'll send it out.
Okay, yeah, because it's really good. Of course, we have some new issues now, but I think at least 50% of what they were talking about then we're still talking about now. So I have one more thing, though.
Great.
So I might have to be quick. So the other thing is I wanted to, I've spoken to some of you about this, but we have at San Diego State, we have a center that's called the National Center for Urban School Transformation. Where we look at bright spots throughout the nation of schools that are low socioeconomic, right? But that are achieving, academically. This year was the first year that we went to include dual language schools throughout the nation. So we have a research team. We went to the school, and so there are 3 schools. We have the bronze, we have the silver, and the gold. And so we were looking specifically at equity, dual language schools with equity. So right now we're still, processing the data, but this is something that I want to share with the group, because as we talk about this, as we talk about equity, as we talk about critical consciousness and leaders really knowing what they're doing, that's what we found in this school. So it's looking for those models, and the reason that we did this is we can talk about it, we can theorize about it. But what does it look like for people that are actually doing it? Okay, what are the parents doing? What are the teachers doing? What are the kids doing?
This is incredibly valuable, because I can tell you, as somebody who gets a lot of questions from reporters, that's always at least the second question. So can you point to me someplace where I can go look at it?
Yes.
So we will get this information. Lisa, did you need to say something?
We said a couple of things back, but when we were talking about who should be involved, and I thought that, there have been people who have been working on behalf of social justice and education for quite some time, and they might be valuable team members, and those are really new schools, Teaching for Change, Southern Poverty Law Center, Teaching Tolerance. I'd love to see those folks in this conversation who have been brokering and working towards this for a long time. There are lessons learned, so there are things that we can do.
Good point. So we've got 4 minutes now. Well, I think, effectively disseminate information. So
How have we done on that, and what do we need to do? Dissemination of information, and well, I know that one of the things is we need to get it out into communities and parents, and we don't have that up there. We've got to figure out how to do that better. But it seems we have to get our act together first before we try and disseminate too much, right?
Yeah. And what are we disseminating? Disseminating, you know, like stating problems and trying to encourage people to address them, or are we telling our proposed solutions to those problems? Or, like, I mean, that's part of what we're also trying to figure out. What exactly is disseminating?
I think we need to package the equity message so that people understand what we mean by equity, what are the issues that are out there that need to be addressed, so that folks can be doing this proactively rather than after building a program that maybe is not very applicable.
It seems like a concrete example of how it could be a place to show
but
how you might address this or
just
how a district or school would change.
I will tell you from reading the 32 responses to the survey, everybody put at the end, please send me more.
Send help.
There is, for everybody in this room who's thought about it, there are 10 times the number of people, 100 times the number of people who have not or don't think about this the same way. So there is a hunger and thirst and need to understand what it is we talked about in the last day and a half and more. So eventually, this issue is really important because it's not something that is, the knowledge base is particularly strong across the country.
I would say that there's different audiences there, so there's going to be different messaging that needs to happen. And so, like, what are the policy questions versus the research questions versus what we have?
Absolutely.
Everybody
and
to
which parents? Because I think we have somewhat different messages for different parent groups.
Yeah, and how do we get our students involved in this line of question?
Certainly.
I also think that there is something to say about the media. Like, how do we disseminate any findings or any results in palatable, accessible ways to the media? And I also want to point to another resource that California Together is developing, because they have a bilingualism and biliteracy campaign where there's a specific messaging that's going to be released very soon, so I can send the link to you so that you can all see it, because it's targeted about valuing bilingualism for some of the communities that we're talking about here. In Spanish.
Really?
Also, once we do have a message that's packaged that's, you know, sellable per se, we need to start going after state legislators, because the money is at the state level. There is money available at the state level, because education in this country is still a state issue. And I think we have to really start working with state legislators to really get messages out. Might be a small bill here, might be a small bill here. But, you know, you see what's happening in California. A small bill passed last year, first money for new language immersion. It's happening in other states. So I think we need to go after state funding to really start helping programs. But it should be for, you know, equity too. So I think we need to embed that in actually the message.
Yeah, well, there are different forms of messaging. I mean, that's one. I'm talking about messaging to inform the field. About, there are some I don't want going out anywhere at this point, because the story they have to tell us might not be a story we necessarily want them to tell. But yes, as soon as they're successful models, that's a different form of messaging.
I just want to say that I've been feeling a little concerned about what we talked about, the silencing of certain voices. And my sense here for the day and a half is that there has been some silencing of certain voices. I'm concerned about the fact that in the question of equity in DLI, we have spent so little time actually looking at the role of the English whole language child in these programs. I don't think we're all on the same page, actually, in terms of how we vision the equity issue. I think we've come from some pretty distinct perspectives here. And I'm not certain that that's been really acknowledged from statements like, of the sharing that Kathy Escamilla has just ticked off, that there are any English one language kids at all, to publications that English speaking families are taking over these programs. This is a very divisive discourse, and this divided discourse is disconcerting to me. I was thinking about the kind of contribution that we've tried to make, or I've tried to make at Carla, and I would say our contribution was fundamentally about trying to bring together those who were fundamentally coming from language minority or minoritized learners' perspectives to those who actually had focused on majority language learners and their need to be involved in these programs, as well as Indigenous revitalization. We've tried so hard to keep that umbrella together, and I feel like it's been increasingly divided, divisive, and I think we're doing, I'm concerned about how much we're actually really building bridges here, and how well we're doing that. So I just have to say that. And secondly, we were part of that 2009 report, and the follow-up report on that was published in 2014 in the Journal of Immersion and Dual Language Education that had a range of chapters. There were 50 researchers brought together to follow up and still identify more really important questions in the field. So as much as I've appreciated this, I have to honestly say, I didn't hear anybody stand up who did a paper basically on what does dual language immersion mean for English home language families. What about that perspective? Where are their needs being met and not being met? And I think that that is part of the equation, and it's sort of the elephant in the room for me a little bit. And I think we needed more time to actually expand the conversation so frankly that the conversation amongst ourselves was a little more inclusive. Because if we can't be inclusive in this group, I certainly have questions about how inclusive our programs are going to be. Or critically conscious.
I appreciate your candor. I think what we've tried to do is bring a lot of different perspectives in one short period of time. We have no doubt not brought all perspectives, nor have we brought each perspective to the same level. But I really appreciate your candor, Tara. It's hard to stand up and say that. And we will attempt to address this in the report, and we will hope that all of you, perhaps who've been silencing yourselves in some way, will include that on a survey that goes out so that you can feel comfortable saying what you really feel, and we can get it all into into a report that reflects the varying perspectives. I think we're at the end of our time. We promised that we would let people out on time. We've begun, Dick, a journey with the people here, which we've tried to expand, but you'll be hearing from us again shortly.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the next one. Thank you.